Welcome, my friends, to the Sage Akwe Radio Hour, your home for free and critical thinking, and I'm your host, Mike Williams. Tonight, Deanna Spingola returns to the show. Deanna is an author, researcher, and radio host. She investigates government and corporate corruption as it relates to the faltering liberties of American citizens and the war-targeted populations of other countries. And as you will hear in this interview, she does not shy away from controversial issues. Deanna's recent books include her Ruling Elite trilogy, along with her newest book, Screening Sandy Hook, Causes and Consequences. With this show, Deanna will walk us through a piece of World War II history that has been erased from the history books. The mainstream narrative of the Second World War majors exclusively on the Holocaust, but never talks about Dwight Eisenhower's Rhine-Meadow death camps, which claimed the lives of an estimated 1.5 million Germans. The running and condition of these enslavement camps was so deplorable that it is virtually incomprehensible to believe anyone, let alone a U.S. general and later a U.S. president, would have treated people in a way that can only be described as evil. For many, much of what you will hear in this show will be a surprise and perhaps even shocking. I encourage everyone to listen with an open mind, and as you do, remember the words of Winston Churchill, "History is written by the victors." And to kick the show off, Deanna takes us through a chronology of Dwight Eisenhower's career, in order to set the background for the discussion, and then she will dive into the history of the Rhine-Meadow death camps. Let's take a listen.
Eisenhower was actually born David Dwight Eisenhower, but then they switched it later because his father was David Jacob Eisenhower. And anyway, Dwight D. Eisenhower was born October 14th, 1890. He was, of course, the 34th president from 1953 until 1961. He graduated from West Point in 1915, where someone referred to him as a Swedish Jew. The website Jew or Not Jew states that he was not a Jew. Wikipedia says the original name was Eisenhower, spelled Eisenhower, and that his family was of Pennsylvania Dutch ancestry, originally from Karlsbrunn, Germany. Now, this is really kind of odd and to me very questionable, as he stated in a letter to his wife, and I quote, "God, I hate the Germans. Why? Because the German is a beast," unquote. And I'm thinking, oh, that's bizarre.
Yeah.
That is really bizarre, because why would anybody whose ancestry was actually Pennsylvania Deutsch, and they came into this country very early on, about 1741 or thereabouts, and I'm thinking, this does not make sense given his ethnicity. His stated ethnicity. Of course, there are a lot of Jews who do adopt Christianity, and I don't know, they did it in Spain, they became Marranos. But anyway, if you look at the history, it just makes you kind of wonder. Because in 1928, Eisenhower met Bernard Baruch, who was known as the King of the Jews, who consistently rewarded his political protégés. And later on August 5th, 1952, the Veterans of Foreign Wars awarded Eisenhower, then campaigning for the presidency, the very first Bernard Baruch Peace Medal. Now, warmongers are constantly receiving peace medals. I don't know, it's kind of a quirky thing. And Eisenhower responded, and I quote, "I was one of those who for the past quarter century has had the privilege of sitting at his feet," meaning Bernard Baruch, "and listening to his words of wisdom, words that are still mighty," unquote. So that would mean, he met him in 1927, 28. In the same speech, he said that he endorsed Baruch policies, those he had been urging for years. Now, after Eisenhower became president, he advocated those policies, including Baruch's UN plan for total disarmament to accommodate the Cold War charade. Now, that plan, which is actually a Rothschild scheme, means, well, disarming always leads to rearming, which translates into huge profits for the Jewish-controlled military industrial complex, the one that Eisenhower, after the fact, warned us about in 1961, just when he was stepping down. Now, Eisenhower entered the 1952 presidential race as a Republican to counter the non-interventionism of Senator Robert A. Taft and to crusade against communism, Korea, and corruption. Now, in the first year of his presidency, Eisenhower deposed the leader of Iran in the 1953 Iranian coup d'etat and covertly opposed Joseph McCarthy and contributed to the end of McCarthyism by openly invoking the modern expanded version of the executive privileged. He continued New Deal agencies, expanded Social Security, launched the interstate highway system, which was a good thing, and created DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. He established the National Defense Education Act. He signed the Civil Rights legislation in 1957-1960, and he implemented desegregation in the armed forces. He did a lot of interesting things. He prioritized nuclear weapons and reduced funding for conventional military forces. In other words, he withdrew the regular ammunition so that they could rearm. In 1954, he introduced the domino theory and described communism as a threat to the United States' global economic and military hegemony. Eisenhower authorized the establishment of NASA after the Soviet Union purportedly launched the world's first artificial satellite in 1957, which would begin the so-called space race. But now, if you go back to 1932, now keep in mind that he met Bernard Baruch in 1928, per his words, and counted him as his mentor. In 1932, per orders from President Herbert Hoover, who was a longtime Rothschild agent, I'm going to call him an agent, per orders from President Herbert Hoover, along with Douglas MacArthur, who was his senior, Eisenhower marched against the veterans of World War I, known as the Bonus Army, which was actually the Bonus Expeditionary Force, which was a desperate group of veterans and their families, or about 43,000 individuals, when they peacefully marched to Washington to collect the $1,000 bonus that the government had promised them, either upon their death or in 1944. But these people were absolutely desperate. Now, marching, using the military against citizens is against the Posse Comitatus Act, which was passed June 16, 1878, which prohibited military force against U.S. Civilians. Now, MacArthur claimed that the protesters were just pretending to be veterans, but they were actually communist and pacifist. And his aide, Courtney Whitney, claimed that they were anti-Americans, criminals, convicts guilty of murder, rape, robbery, manslaughter, and other despicable crimes that had infiltrated the Bonus Army. Now, the VA records showed that 94% of the marchers were, in fact, World War I veterans. Now, they consented to leave, but wishing to retain their dignity, requested that they be allowed to march out in proper military formation. And MacArthur said, "Yes, my friend, of course," quote unquote. Meanwhile, in preparation for a supposedly peaceful removal, six battle tanks, fixed bayonets, and poisonous adamsite gas developed by Roger Adams for use in World War I were assembled. MacArthur ordered his men to burn the encampment. MacArthur's troops injured hundreds of veterans while killing several of them. So, we see here that if you recategorize people and claim that they are evil monsters, it makes it easier to engage in mass slaughter against them. Now, during his presidency, Eisenhower sent federal troops to Little Rock, Arkansas, to enforce federal court orders to desegregate public schools. So, did he learn that back during the Bonus March? Now, Eisenhower at the time was a bit reluctant to do this because he was afraid of what the press would say. Eisenhower was always, he always manipulated the press, or he, at least he used the press, particularly in Germany. He gathered the press to look to see what the Germans had done, which was actually taking the focus off of what the American military, under the direction of Eisenhower, was actually doing in Germany.
So a deflection approach.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, so in 1941, Eisenhower had met Harry Hopkins, and Harry Hopkins was one of Roosevelt's advisors. He was, in fact, one of the architects of the New Deal. And soon after that, top military leaders closely connected to the White House promoted Eisenhower over 1,109 better qualified, more competent officers who actually outranked him. And then, you know, in any war, any commission, any kind of a situation, they will, well, even when you're talking about putting a president in or putting an individual into the White House, you always have to find somebody that's going to do your bidding. And that's exactly what occurred when they promoted Eisenhower above all these other officers who outranked him. And this was in anticipation of imminent war plans. And they first promoted him to a full colonel in March 1941, then to brigadier general in September before the expected and fully anticipated Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. By February 1942, through the influence of General George C. Marshall, who was a Pilgrim Society member, they appointed Eisenhower to the position of Assistant Chief of War Plans Division, where he learned some of the technicalities of executing military assault against Japan and Germany. In March 1942, he was the Chief of Operations Division. In June, he was awarded the position of Commanding General of the European Theater of Operations in London. Then, thanks to Bernard Baruch, they advanced him to the position of Supreme Commander, Allied Expeditionary Force for the invasion of Europe, scheduled for December 1943. Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. Now, Deanna, I was going to ask you the question. When you say they moved him along, who are they?
Okay, the chief, the Joint Chief of Staff was General George C. Marshall. And he was a very compromised individual. He was behind the Marshall Plan after the war. He was most helpful in covering up the Pearl Harbor that the U.S. military, the U.S. government, was fully aware that there was going to be an attack on Pearl Harbor. They monitored the attack from the time it left Japan until they arrived in Hawaii. They covered it up afterwards with a commission. They stacked and appointed a commission. And George C. Marshall was implicated and said, oh, you know, I'll step down. But it, the commission and their conclusions were pretty much hidden from the public. And it was at a time when there were other things going on and it was just not publicized in the newspaper. But it was the Joint Chief of Staffs who, in other words, those the top military leaders who were closely connected to the White House are the ones that put Eisenhower in charge of the European invasion. Simply because of his connections with Bernard Baruch, with Harry Hopkins, with George C. Marshall, who he worked briefly with when he was the Assistant Chief of War Plans Division.
Interesting. Very interesting.
Indeed. Okay. So, FDR and Winston Churchill met in Casablanca in January 1943. And they decided, now keep in mind that the war ended formally in Germany on May 8, 1945. But in January 1943, FDR and Winston Churchill, now Stalin was not, did not meet with them because he was, he had this ongoing conflict in Stalingrad and it was, and so he didn't meet. But Churchill and FDR decided in Casablanca that Germany was going to have an unconditional surrender, which means total post-war submission, the complete eradication of the existing government, and relinquishing all treaty rights, which also covers the treatment of POWs according to the Geneva Conventions, which, of course, the United States had signed. Now, Russia never did sign the Geneva Conventions, so they weren't under those same obligations. Now, in Tehran, where Stalin and FDR and Churchill met, Stalin and FDR drank a toast to the deaths of 50,000 German officers who they laughingly thought that the Allies should immediately shoot at the conclusion of the war. Now, Eisenhower said when they opened the Ruhr operation, R-U-H-R, he said, and I quote, "Our primary purpose is the destruction of as many Germans as possible. I expect to destroy every German west of the Rhine and within that area in which we are attacking." Now, they knew, the U.S. military, the U.S. government knew that Germany was totally unprepared for war. They knew exactly what Germany had as far as military equipment. And of course, Germany was already involved in a war in the East because the war actually started September 1st, 1939. And so they knew that they were going to win over Germany because they were militarily superior. And the whole thing with the war starting in September 1st, 1939 was, of course, because of Polish intervention, Polish sorties into German territory, and because of what the Polish were doing to the German citizens that were living under their jurisdiction. I mean, they were pretty much slaughtering them.
Right.
So, but that's a whole other story. So, now, the Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau, told FDR, he said, and I quote, "No one is studying how to treat Germany roughly along the lines you wanted," unquote. FDR responded, and I quote, "We have got to be tough with Germany, and I mean the German people, not just the Nazis. We either have to castrate the German people, or you have got to treat them in such a manner that they can't just go on reproducing people who want to continue the way they have in the past, unquote. Now, Germany did not want World War I. They did not want World War II and attempted to avoid both wars. And this targeting of Germany goes back to 1848, which I have talked about in my three book series, my trilogy. And they weren't a warfaring people. When you look at France and when you look at the history of Britain, whose empire was so big that the sun could never set on the British Empire, well, you just have to figure out, okay, let's see, let's compare these the histories of these nations. And when Germany did collaborate or have any interaction with other countries, it was always for mutual benefits. They never went in and exploited the resources or the people for cheap labor of any country that they interacted with.
What was their issue, Deanna, with the Germans?
It was because of Federer's plan. It was because of the economic plan. It was because, as Bernard Baruch said, we are going to lick that fellow Hitler. Hitler threw the bankers out. They didn't have any, after World War I, they didn't have any gold. They were totally bombed. They were totally, the country was devastated. The only way that the so-called November criminals signed the Versailles Treaty is because Britain had an embargo against Germany and Germans were starving to death. It was at least 9 months of starvation before Germany, the German leaders, finally signed the Versailles Treaty, which caused them to have to pay reparations, which caused them to concede that they had started the war when in fact they hadn't.
And those reparations were astronomical.
Unbelievable. Yeah. It was unbelievable. Then you had the Weimar Republic, which was disgusting. I mean, Berlin was nothing but it was a sin city. It was absolutely horrible. Also during the war, even before the war, you had a lot of people coming from the East. They went into the country. They exploited people were losing their land, they were losing their resources, and you had a lot of people from the East that came in, and this was a particular ethnic group, and were picking up property pennies on the dollar, or, you know, pennies on the mark. It was a very, very difficult time, and of course, in 1929, you had the premeditated and staged crash of 1929, which was, like I say, it was staged, it was premeditated, it was deliberate. And in fact, Churchill came over to the United States, and he was pretty much celebrating with all the bankers over the crash. So it was because, and I believe it was also, the Germans were always the target. And because I think they're special people. I think that they are, well, the tribe of Judah. I think that they are, chosen. They are special people. They are gifted. They are intuitive. They are creative. They are brilliant. They have a great character. They have integrity. I can't say enough good things about German people.
I agree. I absolutely agree. All of my research has shown the exact same thing.
And it's very interesting. When I was preparing for this today's interview, I couldn't. One of the links that I had in in the third book was dead. Now I have a whole bunch of contacts on my Skype list. I don't talk to everybody all the time. But I just could not find the link, and it was a link that was in German, and I just couldn't find it. And within 10 minutes of trying to find this link, I got a Skype text message from somebody from Germany. And he said, "Hi, how you doing?" And I said, "Oh gosh, I'm doing fine." And I was explaining that I was going to be doing a program about the camps, the Eisenhower's camps, and I couldn't find this link. And he came back within a few minutes with a link, and a link to some other things. And I said, "Gosh, Providence is this is remarkable. This must be Providence." And he said, "There's no such thing as coincidence."
Yeah.
And he shared with me a prophecy that was made in the book of Sajawa, Sajaha. And there were 19 writings of this Babylonian seer. And this was in the ninth book. It was in book 9, which was prophesied 3,000 years ago regarding Adolf Hitler. And the book says, "The third picture that I give you today shows how once a new king arises in the far, and he is of our blood. His name is Hope, because he closes the sources of evil, and each heavenly sign gives him a year, the first half in peace, and in the second at war. But the sources of evil have to leave, and they overwhelm the young king with blood and fire from above and below and from all sides. So he passes, and the name Hope falls with him. Now, there were 12 years of hope, 6 in peace and 6 in war. From 1933 to 1939, the first 6 years, there was great hope in Germany. The people in Germany were not mesmerized. They loved Adolf Hitler because of what he did economically. He raised a people who had been absolutely torn asunder in the First World War, whose country had been wrecked, whose people had been starved. The economy was savaged. And in the first 6 years, he put people back to work, built the Autobahn, did all of these miraculous things between 1933 and 1939. Then between 1939 and 1945, you had blood and fire from above and below and from all sides. From France, from Britain, from America, from the Soviet Union. It took all of those powers and billions of dollars to supply the Soviets so that they could have the equipment to totally destroy Germany.
But Deanna, how do you answer the question that gets posed when we talk about the successes of Adolf Hitler, really bringing Germany out of that ditch and making it robust again, that he did that with the help of the likes of Standard Oil and Ford and so on, that he, you know, he had an unholy alliance in order to do that. How do you respond to that?
He didn't. I cover that in my third book. Most of the industrialists, now he met a lot of the industrialists as early as 1929 when the NSDAP was growing. He met Thyssen, he met a lot of these industrialists who supported him because of his ideas. And there were other individuals like Deterding who contributed because they didn't want Standard coming in and taking over. They didn't want Standard to come in and take over the oil fields that were in Europe. And so not only that, most of the information that people use to say that, oh, he was financed by the Jews or he was financed by Standard, those sources come from Jewish writers. But if you look at some of the actual sources, like the pools, actually cite sources where it was a lot of the German people, the people who belonged to the NSDAP, and their numbers went into the thousands. They had the second most popular party in the elections, so that he became chancellor, not because he forced his way in or took over power unrighteously or illegally. After his stint in jail, because before they thought they'd have to force power, they would have to force the power away from the communists. The communists had infiltrated every other party in Germany except the NSDAP. And it was the common NSDAP member and the common German who contributed what they could to the party.
Okay.
Anyway, I do cover those issues in my third book.
Excellent.
So, okay.
I didn't mean to derail you there.
No, that's great, because I mean, those are questions that people often ask because they are told, oh gosh, the reason that that he could enhance their economic situation is because he was building up the war machine. No, because according to the regulations, the stipulations of the agreements made at the so-called Paris Peace Conference, they could not rearm, and so they didn't. In fact, Hitler was trying to get the others to stop arming. The United States and Britain were building bombs beginning in, well, they had quite a supply by 1936. It was not Germany that was rearming. In fact, Poland had better, they were better militarily. They were more equipped militarily with their airplanes and their subs than Germany.
So when did Germany actually have to start basically crank up the war machine?
When they got invaded by Poland.
So they had essentially, what you're saying is really nothing before that?
Very little. Okay. Whatever they had was, they had a third of what Britain had. Okay. But then you have Britain, you have France, then you have the Soviet Union, who got a lot of materials from Lend-Lease. And you also had, right after, starting in the 20s, you had a lot of companies going into the Soviet Union and helping to build their agri-economy. So you had a lot of influx into the Soviet Union beginning in the 1920s. It wasn't just Lend-Lease. It was a lot of technological advancement beginning in the 1920s, because the United States government was helping to build the communist
yes.
Soviet Union.
Yeah. So. You know, what's even more interesting about this is that on such a short runway, that the Germans' ability to be able to build up their war machine to the degree that they did, when you're saying essentially they didn't really have much
It's miraculous.
It's miraculous. It really is. It's amazing.
It is.
Yeah.
It is miraculous. Because what they were concentrating on was rebuilding the country.
Yeah, that's right.
In fact, the Autobahn was the greatest highway network in the world. The buildings that they were building were wonderful. They were putting people back to work. And meanwhile, the United States was still suffering with soup lines. They were still using outdoor toilets. I'm talking even in Illinois, in the Chicago area. There were a lot of outside plumbing. The United States, instead of building up a war machine, should have been putting their people back to work instead of millions still standing in soup lines.
Even during the Olympics in Germany, there
yes.
was a tremendous amount of German ingenuity and technology that was on
Absolutely.
Display.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't know that.
Exactly. And, you know, the press and the educational apparatus in this country don't want you to know that.
Right. That's right.
Okay. So, even before the Normandy invasion on June 6, 1944, by May of 1943, with the Axis surrender at Tunis, Eisenhower had several hundred thousand German captives who the military had transported in overcrowded boxcars to his infamous camps, which amounted to about 200. And I get very emotional. I'm sorry. I'm going to try to not get emotional.
That's okay.
He wrote in a letter, and I quote, "It is a pity we could not have killed more," unquote. Now, this is a guy that's supposed to be a German whose ethnicity was German. I don't get it.
Yeah, something is not right there. I read a lot of this also, and it's extremely barbaric.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
On February 24th, 1944, he appointed General Everett S. Hughes as his special assistant. And he said, "Emphasis will be placed on the consultative aspect of your duties rather than on the inspection aspect." In other words, take orders, don't ask questions. You don't have direct authority to make any decisions regarding German POWs. General Walter B. Smith, Eisenhower's chief of staff, with unquestionable obedience, later became Truman's CIA director and helped devise the overthrow of Guatemala's president, Arbenz, and also Iran's Mohammad Mossadegh, along with John Foster Dulles. Anyway, okay, with the assistance of Hughes, on August 4th, 1944, Eisenhower consistently reduced the PO rations below those set by the supply officers according to the Geneva Conventions. Now, according to the Geneva Conventions, a captor nation must construct the camp in which they detain POWs so that the conditions are similar to those used by the belligerent's own soldiers in their base camps. They must locate the camps in a healthy area away from the combat zone. They are to provide food of a similar quality and quantity as that of the belligerent's own soldiers. The captor cannot withhold food as a punishment and must also provide local produce, adequate clothing, and sanitary service sufficient to prevent epidemics. They must also provide medical facilities in each camp. Now, if you know anything about Auschwitz, you know that they had an infirmary, they had a hospital, they had adequate clothing, they had a library, they had a theater, they had an orchestra, they even had a house of prostitution.
Yes.
They paid them money to work. They followed the Geneva Conventions. Okay. Now, Eisenhower, he was such a hypocrite. Eisenhower, in a speech in Paris in March 1945, asserted that America would honor the Geneva Conventions with regard to the humane treatment of all German POWs. After all, the United States had signed the conventions way back in 1929, along with 46 other countries. On September 16th, Churchill and FDR agreed to implement the Morgenthau Plan, which included the complete destruction of German industry, which was also against the Geneva Conventions. You don't go into a country that you have subdued and destroy all the industry. You don't do it.
Right. Well, the Morgenthau Plan also had on its radar to eliminate millions of Germans.
Exactly.
Right.
And that is what they did. Now, on March 10th, 1945, Eisenhower signed an order creating a new prisoner category, the Disarmed Enemy Forces, DEFs, in order to avoid or ignore the Geneva Conventions. In other words, they weren't POWs anymore. They were DEFs. And therefore, the individuals, the army did not have to feed the individuals who were DEFs after Germany's surrender. The Allies had between 7 and 8 million DEFs.
7 to 8 million?
Mm-hmm. They captured 4.2 million before the new status. And author Giles Medano writes that these later captives were not entitled to the same levels of shelter and subsistence, unquote.
Well, they had no shelter, no food, and no medical.
Exactly.
They had nothing.
Nothing.
Right.
The Allies also intended to use the Germans, and they did. They used the Germans as slave labor per the Morgenthau Plan, which was discussed in the Moscow Declaration, which was dated November 1st, 1943, and also at Yalta, which was the convention, February 4th through the 11th in 1945, before the end of the war. So, on April 17th, 1945, the United States opened Camp Rheinberg on the Rhine, which is about 6 miles wide in circumference. This was just one of 18 Rhine Meadow enclosures opened in mid-April. The enclosures had little or no food, no buildings, no tents, no cooking facilities, no water, and no latrines.
Now, Deanna, just for our audience's sake, because a lot of people are going to try to get their heads wrapped around this, if you could just take a couple of minutes and, again, just make a comparison between Auschwitz and Rheinberg. What Auschwitz offered and what Rheinberg did not.
All right. Auschwitz had brick buildings that served as the barracks. They had flush toilets. There was an infirmary. There was a hospital. There was a kitchen. There was a library. They could do theater. They could...
soccer games?
Yeah, they had soccer games. They had an orchestra.
Right.
They had all of the amenities that even some of the Polish, because Auschwitz was in Poland, that some of the townspeople came to the camp to hear the orchestra. The people in Auschwitz, they weren't there to be killed. Okay. There was a crematoria there because people die. I mean, people die every day everywhere.
Well, they had typhus.
They had typhus. But they had all these amenities, the laborers, they're all kinds of laborers.
Right.
Jewish laborers, there were all kinds of laborers. International Committee of the Red Cross was allowed to go into Auschwitz, which they were not allowed into the Rhine-Meadow camps, by the way.
Exactly.
And they didn't see anything wrong there. For one thing, when the people got to Auschwitz from the east, they did give them clean uniforms. They shaved their heads because of the lice. The lice were just absolutely horrific, and lice spread typhus. Okay.
Right. That's right.
So they gave everybody the opportunity to clean up. They tattooed them. They're not going to take them there, do all that stuff, clean them up, give them new shoes, new uniforms, tattoo them, and then shoot them. Okay. That's just not. Germans are very efficient, okay? If they were going to, they wouldn't have even taken them to the camp if they were going to kill all of these people. And then there was never 6 million people under their jurisdiction to begin with, because most of the Jews were taken far into the interior of the Soviet Union before the war ever started, for safekeeping, for their safety. But that's another story altogether. But I'm just to compare the camps, flush toilets, I mean, everything. They had running water, kitchens, more than one kitchen, stoves. They had everything that that you could imagine.
Right. So they had shelter, they had food, they had medical.
Yes.
They had leisure.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. The Rheinberg, this one camp, the Rheinberg camp death rate was about 30% a year.
And this is Eisenhower's camp.
Yes.
I just want to make sure the audience is clear on what we're talking about. This is, lack of a better way of expressing this, our camp.
It was their camp.
Their camp. Yeah, okay. You have a better way of expressing it.
I can't. I don't own this.
I agree.
And the Rheinberg camp, Camp Rheinberg on the Rhine, was one of 18 death camps. This was in addition to the 200 that were POW camps, okay? This was for the DEFs, which included anybody they could round up. Men, women, children, 80-year-olds, 8-year-olds, whomever. Also, on April 17th, Eisenhower was focusing the media attention on the liberation of Buchenwald. Now, what they did when the U.S. military went into Buchenwald, they brought in dead bodies from other areas. They were German bodies. They brought in photographers from all over the world. Some of Congress also went over to Germany, and they focused all of this attention on Buchenwald and saying, look what the Germans have done. Look at this. On the very, very same day, on April 17th, 1945, the very same day that Eisenhower and his cronies were opening Camp Rheinberg, they were focusing the media attention of the world on Buchenwald.
So, Deanna, when we see all those pictures of these dead bodies, skeleton-like bodies, what is it that people are seeing?
They are seeing dead German bodies transported from other areas. And you have Hollywood producers, Hollywood directors directing the filming of the so-called liberation of Buchenwald.
So it's all staged?
All staged. It was, as I mentioned in my book, and as one of the directors said, the Holocaust was Hollywood at its best. Staged, directed.
Yeah, a lot of people are going to have a hard time getting their head wrapped around this, but I understand exactly what you're saying.
It's because we have been propagandized for years.
Right.
for years and years, decades, decades.
Decades. Yeah, it's decades.
Yeah. Okay. On April 21st, 4 days later, Eisenhower sent a message to General George C. Marshall, reporting that the new enclosures, and I quote, will provide no shelter or other comforts, unquote. So the top level military, the chief of staffs, Marshall was the chief. He was the top guy under the White House. Knew exactly what Eisenhower was doing, because that's why they sent Eisenhower over there. Now, the DEF prisoners had to improve the enclosures with whatever materials were available. A later order prohibited the prisoners from erecting any kind of shelter. These enclosures were open fields surrounded by barbed wire known as prisoner of war temporary enclosures, complete with searchlights, guard towers, and men with machine guns. At Camp B at Heidesheim, there was no food for several days. There were over 5,000 starving, weak prisoners totally exposed to inclement weather, all in the torturous process of dying. For shelter, many of them dug earth holes in the soft, sandy dirt. It rained hard one night, causing many of those earth shelters to collapse, and the men were powerless to escape from their unexpected entombment. Others tried to unearth the victims, but many suffocated before they could rescue them.
Well, in some cases, Eisenhower's guys plowed over the holes.
They did.
With Germans in them.
They did. And this happened. And to this day. And they did that at the Rheinberg camp in June, because they were going to turn over the camp to the British. And in mid-June 1945, they bulldozed part of the camp and buried live surviving prisoners in their earth holes. Now, according to my German correspondent, the one that I talked to in the last 5 days, people are still not allowed to conduct excavations in the Rhineland meadows, and anybody that attempts to do this is fined.
Now, the other thing, Deanna, I want to make sure the audience understands is the reason for these holes that the Germans were digging was for shelter.
Exactly.
And there would be one, two, three Germans in the hole trying to stay warm because it was cold.
They didn't have blankets.
They had no blankets. And going back to prohibiting the Germans from using materials in order to build shelter, a lot of times that material was cardboard.
Yes.
They were taking cardboard away from the Germans. So they were completely exposed.
Exactly.
I just want to make that clear to the audience so you can understand and put this into context.
Exactly. Now, in early May 1945, because they already had these camps, I mean, probably the dead bodies that they used at Buchenwald came from the Rhine camps. And in early May 1945, the dreaded typhus appeared at Heidesheim. And at the DEF camp at Bingen-Budensheim, there were between 200,000 and 400,000 prisoners with no shelter, no food, no water, no medicine, and insufficient room. These enclosures were not designed for that many prisoners. And so we have typhus going around. Not only are they starving to death with no food, and so the U.S. military moved prisoners in open rail cars around to other camps. And whatever food they did receive infrequently was usually putrid. Oftentimes there was no food at all for 15 days, or there was a watery soup that they gave that the Germans would, if there were grass available, they'd pull up grass, they'd pull up anything that they could to try to add something to this soup that they were getting. And remember that these people were reclassified so that they were not under the Geneva Conventions. And they were supposed to be getting a regular prisoner of war. Even the regular prisoner of war were not getting what they were supposed to be getting. The U.S. military received 4,000 calories per day. That is what the POWs should have been getting.
Well, and what we have is a reclassification for the sole purpose of premeditated evil.
Exactly. Just as they reclassified the bonus army and said they were a bunch of criminals, rapists, murderers, and communists, so that they could then go in and kill them, burn yeah. down their tents. So you just reclassify people.
It's just unbelievable. It really is. Just it unbelievable. Is. People really need to understand the depths of this demented evil.
It is. Yeah.
Anyway.
And they had the equipment, okay? The U.S. government, the Red Cross, all of these organizations had the equipment to supply the food, to supply blankets. Now remember that, at Auschwitz, they had heated brick barracks, okay? Because in April, getting back to the DEF camps, the enclosures, in April, it was cold. It was still cold and rainy, and the weather was awful. And keep in mind that they had these latrines. They were crowded. They were terrible. The camps, in fact, I have a picture of the camp on the back cover of one of the camps on the back cover of my third book. So they didn't have the latrines. In some of the camps, they were crowded, anxious. They were standing almost shoulder to shoulder. They often had to relieve themselves where they stood. There was a growing quagmire of contaminated putrid mud, and the latrines, wherever there were, were actually ditches, were actually death traps for those who slipped.
And many did. Many fell
many,
into.
Many did.
Yeah.
And he did. And they had, the U.S. military had in Europe 50 days worth of 4,000 calorie rations to feed 5 million people by April of 1945. Then they had other lower calorie rations for an additional 50 days that they withheld from the people that they were supposed to be taking care of, the POWs that they were supposed to be taking care of. One of the inmates at Reinberg was over 80 years old. Another was aged 9. And James Back, BACQUE, wrote, "In April 1945, hundreds of thousands of German soldiers, as well as the sick from hospitals, amputees, women auxiliaries, and civilians were caught. Nagging hunger and agonizing thirst were their companions, and they died of dysentery. A cruel heaven pelted them week after week with streams of rain. Amputees slithered like amphibians through the mud, soaking and freezing.
Take your time.
They were naked to the skies, day after day and night after night. They lay desperate in the sand of Rheinberg, or slept exhaustedly into eternity in their collapsing holes, unquote. George Weiss, a survivor, reported that the total absence of water was, and I quote, the worst thing of all. He reported, for 3.5 days we had no water at all. We would drink our own urine. It tasted terrible. But what could we do? Unquote. As I mentioned, the Red Cross, though the Germans invited them into their camps, they had Allied camps too, and 97% of all the POWs from the German camps returned home.
Right.
That's not true. This is very hard to think about.
It is very, very hard. And it's one of the reasons, Deanna, I wanted to do the show. And I knew it would be difficult. Number one, because it cuts across the grain with regard to the indoctrination and the propaganda that the masses have received over the last few decades. And I'm hoping that with the type of stuff that we're seeing in the world today, the constant wars, enemy combatants, military tribunals.
What's an enemy combatant? What is that?
Well,
is that a DEF? It's a DEF.
Yeah. And the point I'm making here is that what we're seeing is history repeating itself. And it's very important to understand that the stuff that's happening today wasn't invented yesterday. And yesterday, like today's Wednesday and, you know, yesterday was Tuesday. That these type of tactics, this type of thinking, this has been in place for a long time by a cabal that is evil.
Exactly.
They're evil.
Yeah. And the U.S. military, as I mentioned, the combined chiefs of staff in Washington approved of Eisenhower's DEF status for all German citizens under U.S. captivity.
Right.
By April 30th, there were 2,062,865 of these civilian prisoners. They were civilians. These were not soldiers. These were civilian prisoners.
These were kids, mothers, fathers,
yes,
grandparents, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Yeah.
So, Deanna, how many Germans lost their lives because of Eisenhower's camps?
One figure says 1.5 million. Another figure, 1,700,000. Just in 1 month, by the end of May 1945, more people died in the enclosures just in 1 month than in the bombing of Hiroshima, which cost 140,000 lives.
And these are numbers. And in fact, I'm going to say that the camps themselves, not in any history book, you're not going to read about it, you're not going to hear about it. Nobody really knows about this.
No one knows about it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of those things in history that happened, and everybody should know about it, but it's been buried, like so many other things. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, we are definitely going to bump up against, and I know it's not for this show, we're going to have those out there that are going to rationalize this and say, well, 1.5 Germans died, but look what they did to the Jews. And I say another show because that's going to get into a whole discussion about what the Holocaust really was and what it was not.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So we won't do that today. Be willing to come back. We can take that on.
Sure.
Why not? Sure. I might as well get pummeled.
If you're gonna get it, you might as well. Yeah,
Yeah,
right.
if I'm going to do this, I
Exactly.
may as well just keep going. So,
Exactly. Well, in the 200 barbed wire enclosures, there were 5,224,310 by June 1945. Okay.
yeah.
All of them were overcrowded, all disease ridden. It was awful.
Now, when
Awful.
did it all come to a closure? When did it conclude, Deanna? When were the Germans allowed to leave these camps?
Some of them were in the camps as late as 1949, because after when the British came in and took over some of the camps, when the French came in and took over some of the camps, they used those that could, they used the Germans for slave labor. Because they said, okay, you are the ones that started the war. The Germans are the ones that started the war. So the Soviets also had slave labor. And none of the ones that were used in slave labor in Russia, in the Soviet Union, ever returned, which is, and they were doing things that they weren't supposed to do, according to the Geneva Conventions. They put the Germans to work digging out landmines and stuff that they weren't supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's right. I remember watching that in the documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah, they had them digging out landmines.
Yeah. I was wrong with that figure. I said 97%. Okay. In 1945, the Red Cross said that 99% of the U.S. POWs held in German camps had survived and were soon returning home. 99%.
99%. Yeah, and we cannot say the same thing about the Rhine-Meadow camps.
Exactly.
Not at all. That's not even close.
Exactly. And as you said, a lot of the people had been propagandized. The American military had been propagandized. There was a gentleman, Martin Brecht, from New York. He was an 18-year-old private. He was one of the guards, and in fact, he wrote about this. He was an interpreter at Andernach along the Rhine River, and he relates how the United States detained about 50,000 prisoners just at that one camp, and they kept women in separate open-air enclosures. The prisoners, as I mentioned, had no coats, blankets, or any visible shelter, compelled to sleep on the ground, often muddy, wet, and cold. They used a trench for human waste. Rations consisted of a thin, watery soup, and he questions his superior officers, and they told him that they were under strict orders from higher up, referring to Eisenhower and, of course, those who were above Eisenhower. And the majority of the guards did not share Breck's compassion for the prisoners, most of all because of the propaganda, which viewed the Germans as subhuman and that they deserved whatever happened to him, because the U.S. government had produced massive amounts of anti-German propaganda for the troops in publications like the Stars and Stripes, which was a GI newspaper, which was filled with reports and graphic photos and nonsense about German concentration camps where they gassed people and did all these horrible things that were in fact not true. And so the Americans who were guarding the Germans in the enclosures, they, even though most of these were civilians, farmers, and working people, they just had absolutely no compassion for them, and in fact were acting exactly in the same way that they had accused the Germans of treating the Jews.
Now, Deanna, you had mentioned that the camps went through 1949, you said?
Yes.
So it's conceivable that somebody could have been in that camp for how long? How many years?
They started 43, 1943.
So it's conceivable that somebody could have spent 5 or 6
Sure.
years in that type of environment?
If they survive
If
that
they
long.
survived it, yeah.
Yeah. Now because some of the US soldiers but on May they thought they were going home. However, now the real occupation began. And Camp Andernach, which is where Brecht was, became known as a killing field, and it was now part of the French zone. So it didn't always remain under US jurisdiction because they did transfer the German prisoners formerly under US jurisdiction to French military authorities. And then those people were force marched to other camps, or they were kept for labor purposes. And by the end of 46, the US military had emptied most of its camps, but the French continued to hold prisoners until 1949. And then between 1947 and 1950, the US government destroyed the majority of the incriminating records regarding its prison camps.
Of course, we would expect no less.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just
Yeah.
unbelievable. It was a living nightmare. It was a living hell for
Yeah.
these folks. It's just really a very, very sad, sad moment in human history. It really is.
Yes. And after the end of the war, of course, Willy Brandt became the American puppet chancellor, and he was in office, well, for 1969 to 74, because actually we still have control over Germany to this day. But according to the Congressional Record of January 29, 1946, Eisenhower said, and I quote, "While I and my subordinates believe that stern justice should be meted out to war criminals by proper legal procedure, we would never condone inhumane or un-American practice upon the helpless, which is one of the crimes for which those war criminals must now stand trial," unquote. And he was talking about the so-called German war criminals. And in on September 27, 1948, the Jewish Theological Seminary of America in New York awarded Eisenhower an honorary humanitarian degree. And what an incredible, I mean, this is so hypocritical. And the audience applauded his efforts in ending the German terror and honored him for his military accomplishments and for the high moral standards that he demonstrated and for his statesmanship and for his humaneness. And they congratulated him as, and I quote, "a soldier of intellectual integrity with a love for peace and his fellow man, a beloved counselor of our people in peace as in war," unquote. Now he's at the Jewish Theological Seminary. In
Yeah.
his acceptance speech, he acknowledged his conviction of what Americans believe in, regardless of race or creed. He said, and I quote, "Our army fights to defend our way of life, freedom for each of us to worship God in our own way," unquote. He said that ancient Jewish leaders, and I quote, "gave birth to the doctrines that the American army fought to defend," unquote. It was just a piece of garbage.
Boy, oh boy.
And after his nomination as president, he told the president of the United Synagogue of America, and I quote, "The Jewish people could not have a better friend than me. I grew up believing that Jews were the chosen people and that they gave us the high ethical and moral principles of our civilization," unquote. Does that make you sick or what?
Yeah, it's just, it's beyond the pale. It really is. And I hope everybody's listening to this and just taking this in and understanding what it is that Deanna's taking us through here. Really unbelievable.
It really is.
So anybody that doubts that there were puppet masters, go put your thinking cap on.
Exactly.
Start doing your research, start doing your homework, start getting into the real world, wake up.
Exactly.
Well, this was Excellent, Deanna. I'm really very happy that we covered this.
I created a website with a list of the camps, the 200 camps, and then I also have a link at the bottom of that site for Michael Palomino's work, and he lists the other camps, the Rhinemeadow camps, and that's a good place to start. So let me give you the website, spingola.com/EisenhowerPOWcamps.html. I will text it to you via Skype here.
Okay, and I'll make sure I include that in the show notes. I'm also going to include for the audience, there was a documentary that I had watched that got me educated on this. And that's how, Deanna, I got to know about your work, because at the end of that documentary, they added one of your shows that was done, I guess, a couple of years ago. And that's what motivated me to get in contact with you. So I'm going to include the link to that documentary also, which I thought was excellent.
Okay.
Okay. All righty. Anything else, Deanna, that you want to get out to the audience? Web pages, radio shows, books?
Well, my books, the Ruling Elite series, it's a trilogy, and book three covers World War II. Book two covers the First World War. And the first book actually covers the Civil War going forward. And that is really where all of this began, when America became a corporatocracy. And, it didn't just start when Hitler came to power. It started long before. Talks about the Marxists who came over and fought with Lincoln. In fact, they got him elected. He would never have been elected without the Marxist.
Yeah, that's another war that has been completely propagandized, the
Oh,
Civil War. Yeah,
absolutely.
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And they practiced total warfare there. You go after the kids, go after the food production,
Yeah.
destroy everything in your path, just like they did in Germany. Destroy everybody and everything in your path.
It's inhumane. You
It
have to take a
is.
step back and you have to wonder and think. What is it that makes a mind or a collective mindset operate that way? Is it a parasite? Is it some kind of mind pathogen? The inhumanity that just permeates these people, it just oozes out of them. It's just, I mentioned it before, I'm going to say it again. It's just pure, unadulterated evil.
Exactly. And people have to wake up to it because, as you stated, this is what is happening to the people now
Oh,
in
yeah.
Iraq, Afghanistan, wherever the U.S. military goes. That's what's happening.
No, take a look at how the Palestinians are treated in Gaza.
Oh my gosh.
There you go.
Oh my gosh. And I can't believe that Americans don't see this. I can't, I, it's just. It's just hard for me to believe that the majority of Americans accept all of this slaughter. I mean, this is when you look at all the wars that America has been involved in from 1846 forward. I mean, can't you just step back and think, how come America's always going after other countries? How come they're always invading other countries? But we Americans typically have this feeling of exclusivity that somehow we have a gift to give to other countries, that we have a right to go in and impose so-called democracy. No, this is all done for the benefit of the corporations who go in and use cheap labor and take resources. This is All war is about resources, whether you're talking about intellectual resources, whether you're talking about natural resources, it's all about controlling the resources of the planet.
Well, they disguise it under pretty words like American exceptionalism,
Sure.
which is nothing else. It's imperialism is what it
Sure
is.
it is.
You know,
Sure it
that's what
is.
it is at the end of the day. And like you said, we are a nation I can't even say we're a nation. We have people, this is what they do. It's a perpetual state of war.
Yes. People are propagandized from the time that they're infants to embrace this kind of a mentality. And this happens through the government schools. And so, of course, it's covered up. Of course, patriotism is the last tactic of a scoundrel or something to that effect. And people, when you're in the government school, you are going to get the government's view of everything. Your
Yeah, or
perception is going to be according to what the government wants you to believe.
if you're watching the state media.
Exactly. And the Herbert Hoover was the Commerce Secretary when the government took over the censorship of the entire media back in 1927. He took control of the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah, old Herbert Hoover. That good guy, supposedly.
None of these guys are good guys.
No.
Well, Deanna, this has been terrific. You
Thank you.
did a great job of getting the information out there and having the facts and the details. And so, would you be willing to come back and talk about other stuff?
Sure.
Okay. I really enjoy the
Absolutely.
discussions because this you're just so informative.
Well, you are such a wonderful host.
Well, thank you. I just listen because I'm learning. I have my guests on, folks like yourself, and I don't pretend to be an expert. I know a little about a lot, but you guys are the experts, and I just learned so much by just doing the shows. Well, Deanna, I think we can probably wrap it up, and what I'll do is I'm going to have this show out quickly because I want to get it out fast so people can take a listen to it. I have a contingency of friends who are waiting for this show, some German friends that they would like the truth to come out.
Yes, Germany needs to have the truth come out.
Yeah,
There are
absolutely.
good people.
And that concludes my interview with Deanna Spingola, and I hope you enjoyed the discussion as much as I did. Deanna's website can be found at www.spingola.com. There you will also find links to purchase her books, along with a plethora of information on other research topics. And as always, I'd like to thank everyone for listening and visiting the blog, Sage of Quay Radio, which can be found by heading over to sageofquayradio.blogspot.com or by visiting our hub website at www.sageofquay.com. Also, if you get a moment, please take a listen to my album, Leaving Dystopia, by heading over to laborofloveMusic.com. And remember, live in truth and always serve creation. It's really that simple. See everyone next week. Be safe, enjoy, and God bless.